There were some lasting consequences to this increased involvement of women during the 1640s. We do need to, I think, qualify that a bit by saying that in some of the ways that women were expressing themselves in the 1640s, they were continuing to refer back to these traditional female roles. So if we look at women petitioners, even the leveller women, so these are women who are associated with this, you know, if we put it crudely, proto-democratic movement in the 1640s, they appeal to Parliament on behalf of their husbands, using these traditional feminine roles as wives and mothers. So in the same way that those women who were petitioning for their husbands had been taken into captivity were petitioning before the Civil War. But what we do also see is, you know, this maintenance, if you like, of a feminine presence in the public sphere. So women as writers, as controversialists, is something that doesn't go away after the restoration of monarchy in 1660. In fact, some of the most famous women authors emerge after 1660. So Ephra Behn and Mary Astle, writers emerging in that post-restoration period. I think the other thing that's maintained is some of these roots for political activity, such as petitioning. So we continue to see women petitioning Parliament and petitioning the Crown going on into the later 17th century and on into the early 18th century. We also have that feature of the political landscape that I talked about, which is women taking on these roles supposed to be the preserve of men because they themselves have a certain stake or see themselves as having a certain stake in society. So women who are property holders, their involvement in politics, we see that continuing after the revolution of 1688. And we also see that in a way the government of the time sees it as necessary because it recognises that women are politically active to monitor the politics of women after the revolution of 1688. So a really striking example of this is after a Jacobite plot in 1722, the so-called Atterbury plot. The year following, oaths of allegiance to George I are tendered to the general public, and these lists of people subscribing to these oaths include large numbers of women. And the reason why women are being asked to subscribe to these oaths is because they've been heavily, one reason is because they've been heavily involved in anti-Hanoverian rioting at the beginning of the 18th century. So it's felt there's almost a need to survey or check on the loyalties of early Georgian women because they've been involved in anti-Hanoverian rioting, other forms of anti-Hanoverian demonstrations. One of the arguments that's made about the 19th century women's suffrage movement is that there were important roots in petitioning activity by women who were members of nonconformist churches, especially Unitarian churches, in support of the abolition of slavery in the very early 19th century. And one of the arguments there is that it's not just about what the women were petitioning for, as it were, and obviously we can see connections between the idea of emancipating slaves and emancipating women, you know, the idea of freeing yourself from bondage, from oppression and so on. But there's also a connection in terms of the practice. So one of the arguments that's made is that because women were petitioning collectively, this provided them with an experience of working as women together for a political cause, which helped form the basis for the subsequent women's suffrage movement. And that is something that I think is building upon the nonconformity itself, which emerges during this, you know, 17th century period, and also that experience of women's petitioning in the 17th and 18th centuries as well. So it's a practice that's quite well established by the point that we're talking about, and is building on these roots of women as being important members of nonconformist churches.